So I'll jump right into tonight's topic, and hopefully it'll be interesting enough to stir up responses, questions, your own insights, and so on. I'd like to begin by making a few general observations, things that stand out for me. One is social, even political, which I, even though I've been warned about it, I continue to pay attention. And one of the things I notice is the role of ideologies. And it seems to me that quite a lot of the divisiveness we find in our society today can be traced to ideologies. People who have a position, they've got an answer, they've got something, and they're sticking to it. Money might play a role too, but for tonight's purposes, I want to point out the role of ideologies, and some of these can be religious. Some incredibly gross things are once again happening in the name of religion, and it's not limited to any particular religion. And I would say it's more a matter of ideology than genuine religion. But that's just my opinion, and I don't want to turn it into an ideology. Another observation is something I hear a lot when teaching on retreats, and I think especially from my birth cohort. I'm a baby boomer. Baby boomers like to talk a lot about experience. The 60s, we got into experience, and we'd go to India or California, and we did various drugs and all kinds of stuff, and we like experience. I hear a lot in the meditation circles in which I teach, roughly the what's called, some people now call Vipassana Buddhism, or others, it's not even really Buddhist, it's insight meditation with a little Buddhism on the edges. And it's common that people will refer to my experience of this, my experience of that. And I've listened to these quite carefully and often had opportunity to ask some questions to dig a little deeper. And what often seems to be the case is my experience is actually an interpretation of an experience. And if I'm not going to go analyze this in depth right now, but if you think about it, you know, experiences are passing pretty quickly. And then we remember them, and we remember some of them, and we make summaries and generalities. And by that point, it's not experience anymore. But we often say, in my experience. But if we look into that, if we really are seeking truth and interested in inquiry, we might find out that what we've done is remembered, summarized, generalized, and interpreted. And therefore, in that process, we can drift quite a bit a ways from the actual experience that we're having constantly right now. There's experience happening, but what we think about the experience might be interpretation, probably is. And what goes into the interpretation, the perspectives from which we interpret can have a big influence on what we report as my experience. As a meditation teacher, when people come to talk about their experience and their practice, it's often important to try to dig down to what actually happened. What we report, and I include myself, isn't always what actually happened. And often it's not possible to go back to what happened because it was a while ago. And what we've carried with us is a memory, a generalization, sometimes an abstraction, and some level of interpretation. So that's a second observation I wanted to make. A third is the explosion of scientific information. I don't follow this closely, but occasionally I'll read articles about the plethora of scientific journals, which also cost a huge amount of money, like $20,000-$30,000 a year for a subscription, so nobody can afford them. So I don't know who reads them, but that's beside the point. My point is that for truth seekers, for meditators, for those who take spiritual life seriously, we have this huge amount of scientific information, theories, opinions, and so on. Plus there's the scientism we'll get in mainstream media. And then we now have access to quality teachings and scholarship from all the world's spiritual traditions. The good side of which is exemplified at a place like this. On the other hand, there's so much. You know, even to keep up with my fairly narrow brand of Buddhism is too much, unless all I want to do is read books and stay up late with blurry eyes looking at a computer screen. So this can leave us with certain quandaries. With all the ideologies, some competing violently, others very seductive, using all the tools of modern psychology and the marketplace. With the explosion of scientific information, with the access through the internet to all kinds of spiritual teachings, including very good stuff, what are we to believe? I come across this where just dealing with roughly Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana Buddhism, you can spend all your time just watching YouTube videos. And then, well, so-and-so says this, and so-and-so says that. What are we to believe? Or if you're somebody who likes to think, and I personally recommend thinking, carefully, critically, and so on, but not too much, how can we figure it out? These are dilemmas that seem to trouble many sincere, good seekers of truth, of peace, of a spiritually meaningful life. Kind of a quandary. John mentioned that I have an affinity for the early Buddhist teachings. And I'm especially interested in what scholarship believes is the earliest layer. Even in the collection that John called the Pali Canon, much of that is clearly of a later date. But there are relatively small pockets that linguistically, stylistically, seem to be the earliest strata. And this is what I primarily study. Partly it's a smaller amount, so it I actually have time to read and reread and ponder and reflect. And some things I've been especially enjoying lately have the Buddha recommending that we don't try to figure it out. And we don't believe things. It seems in the earliest strata of Buddhism, belief is not encouraged. Especially belief in concepts, opinions, theories, ideologies. And most often, those kind of belief systems are seen as a source of conflict and violence. The discourses are titled Quarrels and Disputes and things like that. The Buddha says things like liberation, spiritual perfection, purity, which were operative concepts at that time, a few, maybe 400 years, 500 years before the Common Era. He felt that purity, spiritual perfection, genuine peace, liberation, or release do not come about through beliefs, through opinions, through theories, through ideologies. The blanket term for these is ditti, which is translated views. And a ditti, which has to do with view, when you view something or you have a view, a perspective. But it means especially when we take a position, we see things this way. And our tendency that once we have a view once, we have it again and again, and we begin to entrench it. And his claim in this early strata of teaching is that liberation, genuine peace, and so on, do not come about through views. And views here means beliefs. Even if it's based in a really profound experience, if what we're left is belief, it's still a view, because it's no longer the direct experience. In some of these discourses, the alternative that's recommended is rather than having views, beliefs, theories, ideologies, and so on, is seeing. Etymologically, the words are close, or you could say viewing to keep the etymological connection. But the difference is one is a view that's happened. The other is viewing or seeing that is active, it's process, and it moves. It moves with experiencing, Because notice, even an experience is gone. As soon as we're talking about an experience, it's gone. Experiencing is much closer to what's real and happening now. And so experiencing, seeing, you can put these two together because the notion of seeing here, it's metaphor, it's not just visual. It's being fully present within the experiencing. That's the kind of seeing that's being recommended. And this then brings us to the role of mindfulness. Mindfulness not as a mechanism to build up a lot of experiences and then have interpretations and beliefs and then develop theories, including the right one. The Buddha was very critical about anybody who has the view, this is true, others are wrong. My theory is right, my belief is right, my whatever is the one that's true, and the others are fools. These are close to direct quotes. And that attitude, whenever, you know, we think we see things as they are, and then there are those stupid people who don't see it the way we do. It's so easy to fall into that, and these are one of the major ways that violence comes into our world. Those people don't believe the right thing. Cut off their heads. In America, we don't do that, but we still put people in jail. I'm not going to go off into another topic, though. So what I'm saying, by the way, is somewhat subversive, even within Buddhism. In studying Buddhism in Thailand, I regularly heard or read kind of mainstream institutional Buddhist preachers that would say things like, if you believe what the Buddha said, that's right view. And that's a standard Buddhist term, right view. Other religions, that's wrong view. Or Tibetan Buddhists, that's wrong view. Or some even, you know, if you have the correct Thai view, that's right. If you believe the Sri Lankans, that's, you know. That's just the pettiness between different countries, kind of like France and Germany, or the British and the Irish, or the Yankees and the Southerners, or the Baptists and the Methodists, whatever. So this idea that somebody can have the right view, others have the wrong view. And so they would convince themselves that it was possible to formulate views, and as long as they were the right Buddhist view, that was okay. But if you go back to the actual teachings, that's not what the Buddha was saying. Even if you take the Buddha's teachings and form a view out of it, it might have some provisional benefit, but in itself won't liberate us from suffering, from egoism, from greed, from hatred, from fear, from delusion. Because his teaching wasn't about forming views. Now, he had nothing against listening to wise people. That was recommended, but not to develop beliefs and views, but to get pointers in how to look and see. The teachings are for the purpose of learning how to do sustained looking, which in English we call contemplative practice, meditation, even certain forms of prayer. So the body of teachings are about looking and seeing as active in the midst of life ways to get to the truth, not to hold on to it in a belief, view, or theory, but to experience it so that it changes us. When we cling to a view, we're choosing how to change ourselves, and inevitably it's egoistic. When we hold to a belief, it's inevitably egoistic. Now, provisionally, healthy beliefs, healthy perspectives point us in the right direction, get us going, and can be valuable. That's what Buddhism calls right view. But if we start clinging to them, I'm right, they're wrong, this is the right one, those people don't know what they're talking about, it's no longer going to perform the steering, the guiding function that the teachings were intended for. And this is one of the tragedies I feel in religion, where the provisional nature of a wise living person speaking within a language and a culture, using the metaphors, the terminologies, the concepts available to point to truth, and these get codified, rigidified, institutionalized, and so on, and increasingly lose their liberating potential. So back to the practice that these teachings are advocating. I think I've said plenty now about forming opinions, believing, and all that, intellectualizing, philosophizing, that a certain amount of that might play a role, but will not bring about freedom, liberation, and true peace. In the teachings I'm referring to, that requires seeing. And the seeing, I want to go into this, what kind of seeing is meant. Using different conceptual frames from that period, and I'm not going to go into them in any detail, the seeing is about seeing the basic building blocks of experience. In an experience, there's our sense doors. It's a common notion in India. They're the sense doors. The world is impinging on us, and we're impinging on the world. And in Buddhism, by the way, the world isn't a world out there. It's the world where the impinging happens. Buddhism doesn't actually have a metaphysics of a world existing outside. It doesn't need a position on that. The early teachings are just interested in what's happening right here in the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, the thinking, the remembering, which is the interaction between what's inside us, our biology, our consciousness, our memories, our impulses, and whatever's impinging us. So that's some of the key building blocks of experience. Then there's something else that early Buddhism gave a lot of importance to, is every time there's an experiential event, hearing something, seeing something, tasting, being touched, remembering, thinking, in any experiential event, some of them will be pleasing, some will be displeasing, satisfying, unsatisfying, agreeable, disagreeable. There are various names for these. But this quality of being pleasing or displeasing is another building block of our experiences. You might say this is an opinion, but I would say if you really pay attention, it's hard not to notice that as we go through our day, we see things that are pleasing, attractive, others are uncomfortable, painful, and it's our buttons are being pushed, some in a seductive way, some in a repulsive way, and that's just how life goes. And from that, we often respond with liking and disliking. There's stuff we like, stuff we don't like. Another key building block is the way human beings function, unless there's been serious injury or drug use or something. We name it. We use language, we're symbolic creatures. So if something gets our attention, it's pleasing, it's displeasing, it has our attention, we want to know what it is. And drawing on past experience, learning, vocabulary, we name it. And our names can be simple descriptors like tall, short, but notice tall and short are relative. Green, red, blue. But what's interesting about colors, different cultures see colors differently. There's no abstract, objective color, if you read some of the studies about that. But still, in our language system, our personal histories, we will have names for what just happened. And some of the naming is also evaluative. There's stuff the simplest name is good and bad, which we use a lot. That was good, that was bad, or now it's awesome. And do we say horrendous, you know, and somebody does something we don't like, we call them a terrorist or whatever. I hate you. But it boils down to basically we have our evaluations. And good and bad is kind of one of the basic ones. That's other building blocks of our experience. Some of these are primarily coming from inside. And then we have our reactions. We react somewhat based in biology, somewhat based in habits that we've built up, influenced by childhood, by family of origin, by culture, profession, gender, and many other things. These are some of the key building blocks as I understand them. The seeing is to see these building blocks as they happen. A key term in the teachings about seeing that appears over and over again is to see, let's go back to the basic sense impingement, the sense impact. A sound gets our attention. To see that, to see it coming into being, which is fairly quick, and to see it pass away. That's what we can experience. A sound happening, you know, it peaks and then it dissipates. Thoughts really quick, they come, they go. That can be experienced. A thought, a memory, a sound, seeing something. Some might last a while, some might happen very quickly. Early Buddhism had a loose framework. Later Buddhism got really intellectual and came up with these notions of itty bitty little mind moments, and they would count how many mind moments something would take. Nobody experienced that. They were just sitting in a room thinking too much. But we can watch these building blocks of our daily experience come and go. If you read much Buddhism, you'll come across terms like impermanence. I want to play with this a little bit. Impermanence is an abstraction. This is a little tricky. If you go to certain places, they'll tell you of the importance of seeing impermanence, having insight into impermanence. To be naughty, I'm going to try to point out you can't see impermanence. Impermanence is the summary we give to the seeing of arising and passing, things coming into being, falling apart, being born, dying. All we can see is momentary arisings and passings, coming together, falling apart, birthing, dying. And then when we need to talk about it, we'll form summaries like impermanence. But we don't actually experience impermanence. A lot of people think they do, and I'm using the word think intentionally. That's not the same as actually having a clear experiential knowing of this coming into being and passing. That more or less covers what the seeing is about. Buddhist tradition has listed the insights that happen through this seeing. But I don't want to get into that because the key part is the seeing. And I've become more wary of focusing on the insights we're supposed to have. Because if you're supposed to have them, that sets up certain egoistic habits. For the seeing, certain things are required, it seems. One is careful attention. Just the description I've been giving, the arising and passing away of these things, it happens fairly quickly. Sounds, like right here, sounds are happening, you're seeing things, you might feel your body in your chair, you might be scratching your chin, you might be remembering something you have to pick up on your way home, or you gotta do before you go to bed, or you're thinking this guy's an idiot, or, oh, this is really great, whatever. all these things are going on pretty quickly. So to actually see it as it's happening requires really paying attention. It requires sustained paying attention, not just once in a while. Even though once in a while is better than nothing, there's one place where the Buddha said, seeing impermanence for a finger snap is worth something like much more than a mountain-sized pile of merit-making. I don't remember the second part, but it's a finger snap. If you see clearly something happening and dissolving, that's worth all the good deeds in conventional religion. As somebody who believes, hopefully not too erroneously, that there's been some of those snaps, it also seems we got to keep paying attention so there are more and more of those snaps, so that the snaps begin to undo all the beliefs, opinions, theories, dogmas, etc., that have accumulated. These days, I see my practice more of loosening up views. I used to be trying to figure this stuff out. More and more, it's unfiguring out a lot of what I figured out. And then there's the stuff I go, oh, that's not bad, but be real loose about it, you know, hold it more and more gently. I have my tendencies to having the right view and being precise and things like that. So one finger snap of clear seeing is great. To keep paying attention, to sustain it so the snaps happen more often, more regularly. An article I read by a friend used the word fine-grained. I like that, stuck in my mind, that the seeing is increasingly fine-grained, not just kind of broad, blurry, but really looking with care at the fine-grained nature of our experience. So what I'm talking about is mindfulness, plus a few other things, as understood in early Buddhism. The paying attention part is one aspect of mindfulness. Just to mark out, although it's kind of obvious, we often forget, mindfulness is an English word. And it was developed in Christianity, I believe, to mean certain things before it was ever used to translate the Buddhist term sati or smriti in Sanskrit, which originally meant to remember. But in these teachings, it was less to remember and it's to pay attention and to keep in mind. So I sometimes translate it as recollect, which is closer to how it's translated in Thailand. But in the States, we're stuck with mindfulness. It's a big movement. It's in Time Magazine and Google and McDonald's and everywhere. Can even get it plastic with ketchup on it. But the mindfulness, instead of having a position on it, it's the practice of careful, sustained, fine-grained paying attention and keeping things in mind enough to see clearly. And the more the clarity is held in mind, and that's the role of mindfulness or sati, it can do its work. Our usual ego consciousness thinks, I'm gonna do the work. Whoever, whatever that is, it's an illusion anyway, but it's one that keeps confusing us. As a non-theistic tradition, early Buddhism doesn't attribute the word to the Holy Spirit or God or whatever, but to to natural processes. And with the kind of careful, sustained, fine-grained attention and keeping things in awareness, in attention, stuck things begin to loosen up and dissolve, and then space is allowed for healthy virtues that further foster liberation. And this can happen without beliefs, opinions, and views. The article I just mentioned used the metaphor of archaeology, which I thought was quite nice. On an archaeological dig where in a small area, maybe 4 feet by 4 feet, a grad student or my mom, she's gone on some of these, you're in there with your little brush. It's very carefully brushing away the sediment or whatever to find a piece of bone. And you don't even know if it's useful, but clearing it away very carefully, and then somebody can study it to see if there's valid information. So I kind of like that as a metaphor for the fineness of mindfulness. For this to operate, it requires some support. Support such as slowing down. This kind of careful paying attention, I guess I'll sound old-fashioned or Luddite, but if our noses are in screens and devices all the time and we're hurrying from place to place, are we gonna be able to pay any attention? We maybe are paying a lot of attention to whatever's on the screen, but are we paying attention to our own experience? Slowing down, some quiet, even solitude. I'm not saying absolute solitude, but relative time alone. You can be alone with other people, but as long as there's space for everybody to be attending to what's going on. So quiet, some space, some solitude. I would say working for social conditions that are nonviolent and non-exploitative, which it's gonna take a while. the current social structure doesn't make it easy for people. Some of us are lucky or privileged or whatever, or we worked real hard for 60 years and now we've got some time. Trying to work for a more peaceful, healthy society where more and more people have the space. They're not confronted by racism or sexism or classism or those kinds of things. Another thing I'd like to make a plug for is single tasking. That's my current way to express what's often translated concentration. People here might know the Indian word samadhi. And in a key aspect of samadhi is single tasking. To have a wholehearted focus on one thing. The psychological studies are clear enough, multitasking is an illusion. It's a way to manipulate, keep people off balance, get them to make bad decisions. And boy, did people fall for that. You know, I'm going to be productive, I'm going to be cool by multitasking. To the extent that mothers then had to start arguing, well, mothers are the ultimate multitaskers. But I'll bet you good mothers were serial single taskers. You did this well, then you'd do that, and then you'd go back to this. Samadhi doesn't mean you focus on one thing forever, but whatever you're focusing on right now gets your wholehearted focus. And your focus may have to move every few seconds, every few minutes. Although if you do that, if it's every few seconds constantly, it's incredibly stressful. So the slowing down. But single tasking allows us to be fully present. Multitasking just means being scattered and increases stress levels, diminishes our ability to see, to remember, to understand, etc. So these are my reflections on seeing clearly. We could bring out the lists that describe the fruits of seeing clearly, but to me, those aren't nearly as important as the practices that facilitate and foster seeing clearly. And what's great about seeing clearly, everybody has the capacity. All we have to do is be alive and a relatively stable, balanced human being. And just use the capacities that nature, God, the universe gave us. That's all we need to do it. And it's, again, through paying attention carefully, sustained, or at least regular, and as fine-grained as we're able. Then, from that seeing clearly, purity, liberation, the more profound spiritual meanings can arise.
So I really liked what you were saying about seeing. Two comments. One, I think view and interpretation snuck into some of your definition of seeing. It's probably inevitable. And the other thing, the program to improve seeing, also a viewpoint and interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Could you be more specific?
If I remember correctly, your description of what you'll see when you're seeing, like, for example, arising and and falling of ideas, that's not quite accurate. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes arising happens. Sometimes nothing. There's no arising. And some of the other things that most people experience, for example, when interpretation comes in automatically, that sometimes happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. So that's what I meant by, I guess you have to give some or consideration of what to look for, but as little as possible, I think, is the is the best thing. See what you see, and then these heuristics on how you could have more successful seeing occur. I think they work for some people. Other things work for other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't argue with that. Part of it is paying enough attention to see what works, what doesn't work. My wife and I debate that a lot. I was still speaking with from Buddhist frames, especially early Buddhist ones, which I feel or think or believe are really helpful. But one need not be limited to those or take them overly seriously. And they're meant as starters more than a completely accurate description, which unfortunately Buddhist tradition sometimes claims that this is how it is. And maybe not.
It's how it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And it's up to each of us to really keep looking. Because even if we think we're seeing it, keep looking.
My question is about seeing. And it seems that if we're talking about seeing in an absolute sense, I think that when I'm seeing something, experiencing something, that I'm probably most of what I'm experiencing is probably ignorance. It is probably a misperception of what is actually happening in an absolute sense. And while I may experience those snaps that you mentioned occasionally and have a feeling of clarity, I think that I'm largely experiencing things not as they are in an absolute sense. And then my question is, what can I learn, what can we learn from observing not only those moments of clarity, but also of our perceptions of things as they're happening, and what that says about our practice and about I guess that's a complete thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot in that, so I'll respond to what I can remember. I don't even know if there's any absolute clarity. Not having it to be able to say that there is some absolute. So what I'm working with is the clarity that's happening and times when it's kind of muddled. But then it seems to me noticing that it's somewhat muddled, because there's enough memory of when it was clearer. So a certain level of discrimination, it seems to me, is possible, noticing differences and changes without forming opinions about it. So even being aware that things are kind of duller, cloudier, more muddled, that in itself goes from muddled with a little more clarity to it, as opposed to muddled without noticing it. I think that's where the work is, just noticing, oh, it's kind of muddled. And then back to samadhi or single tasking, there's a connection with some terms in Buddha's teaching we could translate as interest or care. If we really care, you know, if our looking for truth is sincere enough that we keep looking, that can clear things up a bit. So to keep paying attention and to keep looking, we can bring more clarity even when things aren't so clear. And I think that's how it builds. And there's, without a, and maybe there's some absolute clarity, but experientially, I don't know if we know it. So just be working with what is and finding confidence, finding courage in continuing to pay attention.
This is more of a comment, really, but it seems to me like what we're fighting against here is the brain's amazing ability to do pattern recognition and to store that pattern and then just assume that is correct. And that's a hard thing to override because it's been our success all along.
Yeah, yep. Can I respond to that? Though it's not a question. That's partly where the fine grain comes in. That the notion of chaos can help. The difference between a chaotic system and a mechanical system is the pattern in a mechanical system. There's very little variation. But life, like, and this is one of the beauties of meditation based in breathing. Healthy breathing is chaotic. It's not mechanical. There's inbuilt unpredictability in variation. So with, and that's, and life's got that. So if our paying attention is fine-grained enough, we start to see the what we now call chaos, that all these systems, like the heartbeat, the breathing, are chaotic. And maybe that can help counteract what you mentioned, that the patterns aren't, none of it's fixed.